So tonight I want to talk about the very beginning of the Satipatthana Sutta. I was looking at this with someone a while ago, and I've had thought about it, and it turned into this Dharma talk. So, and I want to point out two really interesting things that sort of go along with the title I gave to this talk. Do we need an attitude adjustment towards our practice? And the first is, this is how he starts. Monks, that's you guys, okay? This is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of dukkha and discontent, for acquiring the true method, for the realization of nibbana. This is a pretty amazing statement when you think about it. I mean, what the Buddha is saying here basically is this practice that he's about to describe in the Satipatthana Sutta, this practice is a enlightenment practice. It's the practice that if you follow it leads directly to enlightenment. And so the first part of our attitude adjustment, I think, is sometimes we forget this. Sometimes we forget that that's what this practice is all about. And we sort of turn it into something less. It's a way to make ourselves happy. It's a way to have these pleasant experiences. It's a way to solve my problems. These are all things that are potentially true, but that's not the primary intent of the practice. The primary intent is, as he says here, the surmounting sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of dukkha and discontent, for acquiring the true method, for the realization of nibbana. And this is sort of always has to be in the back of our mind, that this is what this practice is for. Our culture tends to, if we're not careful, water things down, make things into, you know, something less than what they really are. And maybe I'm ranting a little bit, but I'm trying to sort of make sure that we don't water this practice down into something that it isn't, or wasn't, that it wasn't intended to be in the first place anyway. And I'm not saying, you know, that, you know, mindfulness-based stress reduction and all these different things that have arisen out of the mindfulness world are bad. They're just not enough. I think sometimes these practices are sort of like, you know, we have this gaping wound and these practices stick a Band-Aid over this gaping wound. And it might actually make you feel better for a while, but it doesn't heal the wound. It doesn't deal with the disappearance of dukkha and discontent. So that's the first part of the attitude adjustment. Then he goes on and he says he's actually, he hasn't even gone into the, you know, the four foundations of mindfulness yet. He's just describing the attitude, the approach you want to take when you actually practice. And this attitude, as I sort of hinted at in my email, is both our attitude towards formal practice on the cushion, on retreat, but also our practice in the world, our daily practice, because if this stuff only works when we're sitting on the cushion on retreat, why are we bothering? This has to work out there in the world as well. It has to be fruitful in terms of how we live our lives in the world. Anyhow, here's what he says. In regard to the body, a monk abides contemplating the body, diligent, clearly knowing, mindful, free from desires and discontent in regard to the world. That's quite a statement too. And he's basically saying, here's the attitude you want to take towards this practice. He lists four things. He says you need to be ardent or diligent, clearly knowing, mindful, and free from desires and discontent with regards to the world. It's a lot to ask for, huh? But that's the main portion of my talk is about that list of four things. And so let's start with ardent. The first thing is we have to be careful. This is an old-fashioned word. It's not something you don't hear a lot of people talking about ardency anymore. And it has a flavor of sort of strict and stern. It has that sort of flavor to it. So the first thing I did is I looked up some synonyms in a thesaurus. So ardent could also be balanced and sustained, enthusiastic, passionate, fervent, avid, or as Anileo does in his translation, diligent. These are all equally valid ways of thinking. And at that, but that's quite a list, because all of these, that whole list implies, wow, I really like doing this. And I like doing it so much, I'm going to be serious about it. I'm going to really work with this practice. So how do we achieve this ardency? I mean, it's nice for me to sit here and say, well, you know, you should be ardent. Yeah. But if I'm not careful, it turns into just like this wagging finger of me saying, well, you should be ardent, you know. but actually, in Joseph's book, Mindfulness, he lays out these three categories of three ways of developing or increasing your ardency, your enthusiasm. And the first of these is a theme that the Buddha comes back to in many places. And actually, to be honest with you, Joseph is very keen on this particular aspect as well. I found this in several of his books and different places. And that's to contemplate the preciousness of a human birth. Just the fact that we have this body, which is a vehicle we need to practice, and that we then not only have a body, but we somehow or other came in contact with the Dhamma. And then somehow or other we decided we wanted to practice the Dhamma, which is even rarer. I mean, lots of people come in contact with the Dhamma and go, oh, nice stuff. And they could go play ping pong or whatever, you know, whatever people want to do, right? And then some people come in contact with the Dhamma and decide to practice, but they don't stick with it. So it's even rarer to be, you know, take this practice seriously and stick with it. And so ardency can arise just by thinking, wow, look how lucky I've been here. Isn't it amazing that somehow or other, I got this body, I heard the Dhamma, I became enthusiastic enough to want to practice the Dhamma, and even became even more enthusiastic because I'm sticking with it. This is an extremely rare thing in the world. And I think all of you right here, right now, this is true. You're ardent, but we have to sort of be aware of that, and sort of let ourselves come back to that, going, yeah, this is great. Okay. I want to read something else. There's several things I want to read, but I'm going to actually have to stand up and turn on my light because the sun's gone behind the mountains. It's sunny for so long now that you forget how it isn't always sunny. So this is from the Majjhima Nikaya. And this is just, it's a beautiful image the Buddha gives in this sutta about this idea of how rare it is that we actually have a human birth. I mean, think of all the beings in this world. Yeah, well, there's 7 billion or so people. But you think of actual beings, it's like trillions and trillions of them, right? Okay. So this is, he's describing in this sutta how rare it is, how difficult it is to get a human birth. Suppose a man threw into the sea a yoke, so something round, with one hole in it, and the east wind carried it to the west, and the west wind carried it to the east, and the north wind carried it to the south, and the south wind carried it to the north. In other words, it floated all over the place, right? Suppose there were a blind turtle that came up once at the end of each century. What do you think, bhikkhus? Would that blind turtle put his neck into that yoke that with one hole in it? He might, venerable sir, sometimes or other at the end of a long period. And then the Buddha says, bhikkhus, the blind turtle would sooner put his neck into that yoke with a single hole in it than a fool once gone to perdition would take to regain a human state. This is rare. This is a pretty amazing description of rare, right? But this is, and you know, this is of course, you know, the Buddha is taking some poetic license here perhaps, which he does from time to time. But I think it's just a great description of that we don't realize how lucky we are just to have this body, actually have a human body, a functioning human body that has all its parts, that we have enough to eat and a roof over our head, and we're not just struggling to stay alive every day. We're not struggling every day to not, you know, get blown up or shot or all those things that people have to struggle with. We have this incredible capability, this blessing to have this body and encounter the practice and then actually choose the practice. Okay. So then so this is sort of repeating what I've been saying, but it's a different set of words. This is from Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, who's a Tibetan teacher. And it's interesting that this is coming from the Tibetan perspective, but it's, you know, it's a different image in a sense. Ask yourself how many of the billions of inhabitants of this planet have any idea how rare it is to have been born as a human being? How many of those who understand the rarity of human birth ever think of using that chance to practice the Dhamma? How many of those who practice actually do? How many of those who start continue? But once you see the unique opportunity that human life can bring, you will definitely direct all your energy into reaping its true worth by putting the Dhamma into practice. And it's like, that's part of becoming awakened. It's like that first moment of, you know, right understanding. You know, there we are at the beginning of the Eightfold Path. you know, right understanding is, wow, this is amazing that I've actually got this opportunity. So that's one way to create more ardency. Another is to reflect on impermanence. Once we start to actually tune into through our practice or through what we're reading or whatever, we start tuning into the fact that how everything is impermanent. What quickly follows, if we start to really think about it, is this is impermanent too, this body. This is just as impermanent. This body mind that's functioning so well right now. Here I am talking, here I am listening. I mean, like, there's this thing happening here. This isn't going to last forever. Yeah. My old teacher, Swami Vishnudevananda, used to have this thing he used to do. I know some of you have heard this before, but I find it interesting. So this is in the Hindu yoga tradition. He asked this question, especially when there's a bunch of newcomers at one of the sanghas. He'd say, what's the difference between yesterday and today? And if we knew the answer, we weren't allowed to say it. So we had to let the other people, you know. And then say things like, well, you know, yesterday was Wednesday and today's Thursday. Or yesterday was sunny and today it's raining. Or like all of what we think would be logical answers to the question, what's the difference between yesterday and today? And he'd let people go on for a while with these answers. Then he'd say, no, you don't have it. The difference between yesterday and today is the day we're all one day closer to death. And it was like, I was in my 30s when he used to say this. And it was always like, oh, Swami Vishnu, he's so depressing. You know, here he is going on about death again. But what he was trying to do, all he was trying to do is to get us to reflect on impermanence, to wake up to the fact that right now we're capable of practice. Right now we're actually have a functioning human body, and we're not in a position where we can't practice for all kinds of physical or mental or emotional or, you know, financial reasons. We can practice. But who knows how long that's going to last? Who knows? You have no idea how long that's going to last. You know, I work in, you know, I do, I'm a volunteer chaplain in the hospital. And every time I go there, I meet someone who something has happened to them. And just like that, their life has changed. Totally changed. And these aren't necessarily older people. It could be younger, you know, people who are in serious accidents without, you know, not having courted the accident, just like stuff happened. And all of a sudden, there they are, strapped to this bed, maybe never been able to walk again. Or traumatic brain injury. Or they had a stroke or a heart attack for some of the older people. We really don't know when that's going to happen or how it's going to happen. But all of us, every one of us, guaranteed this body mind is impermanent, and one day it's not going to work anymore, and practice is either going to be impossible or much, much more difficult. This gives me ardency. It's like, okay, I better practice now while I can, right? Makes sense. The third way is to bring about ardency is to reflect on the whole concept of karma. And I just wanted to read a little bit here from the Dhammapada. This is the first two verses in the Dhammapada. Phenomena are preceded by the heart, ruled by the heart, made of the heart. If you speak or act with a corrupted heart, then suffering follows you as the wheel of the cart, the track of the ox that pulls it. Phenomena are preceded by the heart, ruled by the heart, made of the heart. If you speak or act with a calm, bright heart, then happiness follows you like a shadow that never leaves. This is a reflection on the fact that the situation we're in now, where we're capable of practicing and we have this opportunity to practice, partly is a result of karma from past lives, if you want to believe that way. But also it's like at any minute we could do something that karma changes. And all of a sudden we get swept up into some really complicated situation and now we can't practice anymore. Yeah. And that's a third thing that we have to remember. And that's not really about, so related to impermanence, but it's more about, we have to realize that we're totally responsible for the results of our actions of body, speech, and mind, and how those reactions to those actions of body, speech, and mind affect our ability to practice. And so ardency arises when we start to actually steer our lives so that we're ruled by the heart and made of the heart. So that if we speak and act with a calm, bright heart, then happiness follows you. It's so simple. The whole, and this isn't, we're not going into the deep layers and layers of karma. Just think about how we act in the world affects what happens to us. And what happens to us affects our ability to practice or not. Okay, so that's the first of these four parts of attitude adjustment. You know, this idea that we must be ardent, that we must be enthusiastic, passionate, fervent, whatever word you like to use there. Then the next thing on that in the sutta, he says, we should be clearly knowing. Clearly knowing is an interesting set of words that is often, you see it often in the sutta. And it really means that we have clear comprehension, that we're fully aware of what's happening all the time, that we see clearly what's in process in our lives and in our practice. And this could be, as I said, sitting on a cushion and seeing things arise in the mind, or arise in the body mind, or it could be living our lives in the world. Equally important in both situations. And basically what the Buddha is getting at here is that it allows us to see the motivating force behind an action. So we see an intention arising, a motivation arising to do something or say something. And clearly knowing allows us to see, is that wholesome? Does this make sense for me to actually act or speak in this way or think in this way? And that the guiding principle is simply, is it wholesome or unwholesome? It sounds incredibly simple. And often it is. Often, I mean, how many times do we catch ourselves in the midst of saying something or doing something and going, Oh my God, how could I have been so stupid, right? You whack yourself on the forehead and you go, oh, here I go again. It's just because we didn't pause. We weren't clearly knowing. We didn't see the motivation, the energy behind the action. And that is a really important part of the practice. That has mostly nothing to do with our sitting practice. This is more to do with our life practice, I think. Though often we're sitting on the cushion and the thought arises, oh, that's long enough. I think I'll get up now. Even though, you know, you've only been sitting there 5 minutes, but oh, I think I'll have a short practice today. You know, you see the motivation that behind that and you go, oh, it's not a particularly wholesome emotion. It's not a particularly wholesome idea. I sat down here planning to sit for 30 minutes and here it is 5 minutes into the sit and I'm thinking about getting up. You know, it's because I got important stuff to do today. That's usually my excuse anyway. It's like I got so many important things to do. I can't wait. I can't just sit here. Yeah. And that's, you don't see clearly see the motivation, but you see that in the larger perspective in our lives as well. There is, a really interesting sutta here. This is a sutta where the Buddha, the Buddha wandered, has come to where these three bhikkhus have been practicing together in the forest, and they're co-housing. I mean, they share duties together, and they sort of, it's a cooperative effort with the three of them. And the Buddhist says, well, how's it, you know, basically says, how's it going, you know? And this is what one of them replies. So surely, Venerable Sir, we are living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. And the Buddha says, but how do you live thus? Venerable Sir, as to that, I think thus. It is a great gain for me that I am living with such companions in the holy life. I really understand how that Sangha is so important, and look at what Sangha gives me. I maintain bodily acts of loving kindness towards those venerable ones, both openly and privately. I maintain verbal acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. I maintain mental acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. I consider, why should I not set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do? Then I set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do. We are different in body, Venerable Sir, but one in mind. The other two bhikkhus spoke the same way. That is how, Venerable Sir, we are living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes. Good, good, says the Buddha. I hope you all abide diligent, ardent, and resolute. Oh, here we are. Here we are again. But how do you abide thus? Venerable Sir, as to that, whichever of us returns first from the village with alms food. So the monks are living in the forest and they go to the village every day to collect alms. This is how they feed themselves, right? Venerable Sir, as to that, whichever of us returns first from the village with alms food, prepares the seats, sets out the water for drinking and for washing, and puts the refuse bucket in its place. Whichever of us returns last eats any food left over if he wishes. Otherwise, he throws it away where there's no greenery or drops it into water where there's no life. So he disposes of it properly. He puts away the seeds and the drink water for drinking and for washing. He puts away the refuse bucket after washing it, and he sweeps out the refectory. Whoever notices that the pots of water for drinking, washing, or the latrine are low or even empty takes care of them. If they are too heavy for him, he calls someone else by a signal of the hand, and they move it by joining hands. But because of this, we do not break out into speech. But every 5 days, we sit together all night discussing the Dhamma. That is how we abide, diligent, ardent, and resolute. I love this because it indicates how clearly knowing they are. It's like they've figured out that by living in this very simple cooperative way, without taking turns officially or any of those things, they just take care of all the physical part of their lives so they can focus their practice on actually doing the practice. It's just this beautiful, the energy of this whole sutta thrills me because it indicates how simple it is and how if we consider the needs of others, and here we are in the real world, if we consider the needs of others, often that's the road to having a quiet and simple life, not disputing. And that might be difficult, I understand that in the real world, but it's a thing we all need to think about. Yeah, it's a way to adjust, it's an attitude adjustment we might want to make towards how we live our lives in the world. Okay. Then there's another part of this clearly knowing. And this is once again from Joseph's book, Mindfulness. And he's talking more about this aspect of motivation. Awareness of motivation plays a central role in the path of liberation. As we settle into a growing awareness of ourselves, we begin to realize that our practice is not for ourselves alone, but can be for the benefit and happiness of all beings. How does our practice benefit others? How does feeling our breath or taking a mindful step help anyone else? It happens in several ways. The more we understand our own mind, the more we understand everyone else. We increasingly feel the commonality of our human condition, of what creates suffering and how we can be free. Our practice also benefits others through the transformation of how we are in the world. If we're more accepting, more peaceful, less judgmental, less selfish, then the whole world is that much more loving and peaceful. That much more less judgmental and selfish. Our mind body is a vibrating, resonating energy system. Of necessity, how we are affects everyone around us. On a boat in the middle of a great storm, one wise, calm person can bring everyone to safety. The world is like that boat, tossed by the storms of greed and hatred and fear. Can we be the one of those people to help keep it safe? That's a great question. Huh? So that's that motivation. That's a motivation on a larger scale, I suppose, that we want to. Can we be that person who helps keep the world safe and make it a better place through our practice and through the energy that our practice sends out into the world, sends into all. People tune in to your energy all the time. And if that energy is calm and still and focused, it affects them, quite clearly affects people. I see it myself, both when I am the one who's affected and I'm the one who's being affected. Because I've always been in both those situations many times, sometimes in the same day, many times in the same day, even. It's something to contemplate and make part of the motivation of our practice. You know, to be a source of wholesome energy in the world. It's important that people are like that. I mean, just look what happens if, even if we're never enlightened in this lifetime. You know, any of us could be, but even if we're not, even if all we've done is made ourselves, you know, there's a Sharon Salzberg line that says 10% better. That 10% makes a huge difference to everyone around us. Just by consciously choosing to be through this practice and be that source of energy in the world. Okay. So that's ardent and clearly knowing. Then we come to mindful. Ah, here we are, mindfulness. We finally got to meditation, right? But mindfulness, and the word mindful is a one translation you often see of the Pali word sati, you know, the Satipatthana Sutta, the mindfulness wisdom teachings. Mindfulness leads to wisdom, right? But it's also another translation of sati that's equally valid. It's simply the word remembering. Think of what we're doing when we actually do our practice. Either our, you know, let's just look at our formal sitting practice first. There we are, we're sitting there, paying attention to our primary meditation object, whether it's just simply the breath or this sort of broader view of noting what's arising and noting what's most prominent and where the object is continually changing. And then the mind drifts off. As it does, we all know that. Go into blah, blah, blah. We're thinking about work, we're thinking about our relationship with our partner, thinking about our mother, or who knows, we're thinking about something. And what are we gonna have for dinner tonight? You know, who knows what we're thinking about, but our mind, we forget that we're practicing. The mind drifts. And then at some point, it's like, oh, we wake up. There's an awake moment of pure awakening. And we go, oh yeah, I was practicing. You know, we may not use those words, but it's like, and then we go back and we practice more formally again. Whether it's in how that happens, I mean, there's lots of different ways that happens. So in this sense, This word remembering is a really pretty good description of our moment-to-moment practice, where we're constantly remembering to stay with our object of meditation. This also sort of in a larger context, where we can look and see that mindfulness is both in our formal sitting practice and probably much more so in our daily lives, has this sort of protective quality. Yeah. In the day-to-day moment, the mindfulness is like keeping us on the meditation object, which leads to, you know, getting to the place where clear knowing is more likely to occur. Right. And that protects us from veering off the straight and narrow, the wholesome path. That's what mindfulness does. It keeps us on target, on in process, in along the right road. And so in that sense, mindfulness is protective. It's also protective in the larger sense of in our just day-to-day lives. The more mindful we are in our day-to-day lives, the less likely it's going to be that we get into situations that cause us distress. If we're mindful, as we, you know, I'll tell you, I've been working in a place right now where we're actually pouring footers for a deck, right? So there's these giant holes in the ground that are have mounds of dirt all around them. And if I'm not really mindful as I'm walking around the site, just walking, I'll slide into a hole, I'll crash into a bunch of cement or maybe some rebar that's sticking out of the cement. I mean, I can really hurt myself just like that. So I have to be really mindful. And my mindfulness protects me from literally causing myself bodily injury. And this is a gross example, but it's like, that's what we mean by mindfulness being protective. If I wasn't being mindful, if I was like, as I was wandering around the site, you know, thinking about, oh, what's going to be for dinner and blah, 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 blah. Oh, look, there's the moose over there, because sometimes there's the moose over there, whatever it is. I'd be getting distracted. I'll fall into one of those holes for sure. And these are deep. These are like 3 feet, 4 feet deep holes with cement and rebar sticking out of them and stuff. So it's like, it would be serious if I fell into one of these holes. So that's that mind, that protective nature of mindfulness. There is one other aspect of mindfulness that I want to mention briefly, and that there are really two forms of mindfulness. And primarily what I've been talking about for months now and practice primarily myself is what can be called fabricated mindfulness. Fabricated means I'm choosing a particular form, in my case, noting practice, to keep me focused on my meditation object, to keep me mindful. That's called fabricated mindfulness. Well, if there's fabricated, then guess what? There's unfabricated, the opposite in a sense. And unfabricated is more sort of open. It's more, there's no process underlying it. I'm not fabricating mindfulness. I'm just sitting and seeing what happens. And different Buddhist schools lean more one way or the other. So all Buddhist schools have some balance of those two. And certainly at times, in my own experience, though primarily I worked in this fabricated form, there are times when I've sort of, I suppose the words would be, slipped into unfabricated practice. Whereas other people would very consciously choose to just work in that unfabricated way. And you see this in certain Buddhist schools like Zen. Zen is fabricated in the sense that it has this very precise form, how everything is actually done. Like, you know, to get food in your bowl, you hold it a certain way and you say a certain thing and you bow a certain way and someone will put food in your bowl. So there's that fabrication of ritual. But the actual mental instruction of the sitting practice is like, just sit there and see what happens. Or this one school of Zen anyway. And so I just wanted to point this out, that when we say, when the Buddha says mindful, it's quite an open thing. What I teach and what I've learned and practiced from the people I've studied with is quite fabricated most of the time. I just want to just throw that out there. Okay. Then we come to this final thing on the list. So we have ardent, clearly knowing, mindful, and then free from desires and discontent. Gee, if I'm free from desires and discontent, I'm not, which is another way of saying, I'm not clinging to anything. Wouldn't that be nice? This is like what it means to have a concentrated mind. So we got mindfulness and concentration. Oh, here we are at the final two steps of the Eightfold Path, right? And concentration is another way to keep us having the right attitude, actually consciously choosing a concentrated mental state, constantly choosing a practice form that creates the causes and conditions such that concentration can arise. I want to be precise here, because we can't really practice concentration. Concentration is just a wholesome mind state that arises. We can do is practice creating conditions such that concentration will arise. But one last thing here. This is once again from Joseph's book. And he's talking about concentration and about the benefits, I suppose, of concentration, why it's so important. He's talking about deepening our concentration. So if we're ardent and we're clearly knowing and we're mindful, we can deepen our concentration. And so the question might be, so what? Well, why bother? Why is that so important? One of the great gifts of deepening concentration is that it helps to keep the various mental hindrances at bay. It's like building a fence to keep out unwanted intruders. By temporarily dampening the force of lust and craving, aversion and restlessness, it opens us to more refined pleasures of the mind. Sounds kind of nice. Huh? We can do with some refined pleasures, right? But what he's saying here is that as you get more concentrated, the kalesas, the hindrances, either don't arise at all, or if they do arise, you see them very clearly and they just disappear. You're mindful of the fact that's what's happening, and you don't get hooked. And this more refined pleasures of the mind arise. This in turn gives us impetus to develop concentration even more. Over time, we see the default level of concentration increase in our minds, which changes how we feel and how we are in the world. We create an inner environment of peace. Although concentration is not the final goal of the practice, still it plays an essential role in the path of awakening. This is really important to understand too, that concentration, we're not doing this just to get to be really concentrated. And this is where we can easily get distracted in this practice. That's what happened to the Buddha initially. The Buddha, when he first went out, he went and studied with two of the great concentration masters of the day and quickly learned everything they had to teach him. And in both cases, they sort of made him their joint teacher. So they were like, going to be equally in charge of the Sangha. These are very famous senior bhikkhus. And in both cases, the Buddha got to the point where he's going, yes, but this isn't enough. When I become really concentrated, where I go into these peaceful places where I experience the pleasures of the mind, I'm not suffering. I found a way to stop suffering. But I can't just sit there in these deeply concentrated states all the time. I have to live out in the world. And as soon as I come back, in a sense, you know, maybe I'm concentrated for a day or two, as he would be. Then I'm back in the world and I gotta, you know, get a meal and talk to this guy sitting next to me and stuff happens. And at that point, I'm back to being just another human being suffering. So concentration isn't the end, but, okay. Go back to Joseph here. Although concentration is not the final goal of the practice, still it plays an essential role on the path of awakening. The Buddha emphasizes this when he said that respect for concentration is one of the things that leads to the longevity of the Dhamma, to its non-decay and non-disappearance. So one of the reasons that the teachings of the Buddha haven't disappeared over the last 2,500 years is because people who practice them have learned to be very concentrated. This is an important statement for the transmission of Dhamma to the West. We would like everything to be instant, even enlightenment. Instant enlightenment, it sounds like a great product name, right? And we often don't want to put in the time or effort to develop and deepen our concentration. But as samadhi, concentration, gets stronger in our daily lives, it helps us find that place where we increasingly abide free of desires and discontent in regard to the world. And this peaceful composure becomes the basis for greater happiness and freedom. Sounds pretty important to me. So that's this. We have these four things. We want to be ardent. We can increase ardency by reflecting on the preciousness of the birth, the preciousness of having encountered the practice. Reflect on impermanence and how this ability to practice, you know, may not last that long. And reflecting on karma, on how things can arise. Totally seems at random, but may in essence be a result of past karma. Or equally important, we see how we act in the moment right now affects what arises in our life 30 seconds later or 30 years later, perhaps, what is going to arise. And that we need to be very conscious of living a life of blamelessness so that what's arising is wholesome. Clearly knowing that, having this clear understanding of how everything has underneath every action of body, speech, and mind has an underlying motivation. In another place in this, the Buddha says that there is nothing that we do, nothing that we do consciously that doesn't always have a preceding moment of pure intention. The mind, you know, the mental formation of intention arises, and then we act on that intention, and then something actually happens. Without intention, nothing would happen. Other than things that are, you know, bodily reactions to things that are automatic. You know, someone taps your knee with a little rubber hammer and your foot sticks out. Well, sorry, there was no intention there. That was just, maybe there's an intention with the doctor, but you had no intention, right? You just were reacting. But everything else, there's an intention behind things. And we see that intention. We see how that intention has a certain motivation, a certain flavor. Then we can start making very wise choices that lead towards wholesomeness. Then we have to remember that mindfulness has a lot to do with remembering, to actually being tuned into paying attention to what we're doing right now. And we have to have that sort of balancing that mindfulness is concentration. That we have to be concentrated, we have to pay very careful attention on a moment-to-moment basis, which is what concentration is. And all four of those things together create a certain attitude that we take towards our practice. And by thinking about these things, we might have an attitude adjustment, hence the title of the talk. Maybe we have to adjust our attitude. Maybe we're practicing very diligently, but with the wrong attitude. And by making an attitude adjustment, we can shift to a more wholesome, more vibrant practice. So the plan goes anyway. So I wanted to, as I often do, almost every time I teach, finish with a poem. And this is just one of my favorite Mary Oliver poems, where she's in some senses talking about the attitude that she takes to life, which is very much along the lines of what I've just been talking about. It's called Snow Geese. Oh, to love what is lovely and will not last. What a task to ask of anything or anyone, yet it is ours, and not by the century or the year, but by the hours. One day I heard above me and above the sting of the wind, a sound I did not know, and my look shot upwards. It was a flock of snow geese, winging it faster than the ones we usually see, and being the color of snow, catching the sun, so they were in part at least golden. I held my breath, as we do sometimes to stop time when something wonderful has touched us, as with a match which is lit and bright but does not hurt in the common way, but delightfully, as if delight were the most serious thing you ever felt. The geese flew on. I've never seen them again. Maybe I will someday, somewhere. Maybe I won't. It doesn't matter. What matters is that when I saw them, I saw them as through the veil, secretly, joyfully, clearly. That's pure practice coming to fruition in that moment. That's what she's describing. She was mindful all the time. She was incredible. If you read her poetry, you know how she describes things. She was just this mindful person. She is this, I mean, I shouldn't say what she is, this mindful person who goes through life very open to what's arising around her and then taking it in. And then, lucky for us, expressing it in beautiful words as well. This is, by the way, from her book called Why I Wake Early, which is one of my favorites of her poetry collections. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere. Thank you.